David Baldacci is with me. He's from Richmond, Virginia, still makes his home in Virginia, an inductee of the 2006 Hall of Fame. I was in 1998, so we are fellow inductees of the Virginia Communications Hall of Fame, author of at least 20 novels, plus short stories, essays, books for children, and a new book coming out, Sixth Man.
Yes.
I'm Lou Dean for the Virginia Voice. David Baldacci is with me. You trained to be a lawyer. What day did you go into writing?
Well, I've been writing since I was a kid. I started out as a short story writer. Very difficult to make a living doing that, unless your name is John Updike. So I just wrote and wrote and wrote, and I went to law school because I needed to earn a living, had a family, with that dream, that secret passion of, you know, becoming a full-time writer. And eventually the dream came true. When I was practicing law in Washington, I sold my first novel, Absolute Power, and that really changed my whole life.
You were writing short stories before that.
Yes, I went from short stories, and I wrote screenplays for years because it was just another way to tell a story. And I attempted a number of novels, never finished any of them, but went to probably 3 or 4 or 5 novels, 100 pages, 200 pages, then just lost interest in the story. Then I found an idea for The President and a Burglar and a Cover-Up, and it took 3 years to write that book, writing in the middle of the night, basically, while I was working as a trial lawyer, and that really changed my life.
I want to talk about Absolute Power, but did you have these stories just aching to get out?
There were a lot of stories that I had, particularly as a kid. You know, growing up in Virginia and in Richmond, very historical state, a lot of interesting personalities down here. My family's been in Virginia for my mother's side hundreds of years, so I had a very great connection to this place. And I like to tell stories about family, generational stories, where people are sort of located in a particular place and they have a history that's attached to that place. And some of my short stories dealt with that. A number of my screenplays dealt with that. I never had this ambition to be a best-selling thriller writer. Absolute Power was just another story it came to. When I started working in Washington, I worked near the White House. Occasionally, I would see the presidential motorcade. I saw the Secret Service from time to time. And this idea just hit me. And I thought, you know, this is interesting. It's sort of a moral dilemma. The Secret Service, they do their job, they protect the president, but that makes them bad guys. That's an interesting story.
I digress a little bit, but you mentioned being here in Virginia. You grew up right around our studios here.
I did. I went to high school right across the street in Noraco High School, and that's one reason I'm back here, to help the county celebrate its 400th anniversary, so very familiar with the surroundings.
Absolute Power, your first novel that was published, but how did you manage to get that published after a mound of rejection slips on short stories?
Yeah.
Finally, you get an agent or...
I knew I needed an agent. So I had researched the field. I knew I needed an agent. And the way I got that, I would go down to the bookstore when I heard about a first-time novelist hitting it big. And they always thanked their agent in the acknowledgments in the book. So I got names of like 6 agents just that way that told me the agent would take a first-time novelist. Many of them don't. And that agent had sort of the wherewithal to get the first-time novelist through the gauntlet of publishing. So I accumulated 6 or 7 names. I had finished Absolute Power, the manuscript. I sent up a query letter and the manuscript to all 6 at the same time. I told them it was a simultaneous submission. I gave them a couple of sentences description of the book. I said, I guarantee if you read the first page of this book, you won't stop until you read the last page. And the reason I did that was I needed to have chutzpah, because if I couldn't be confident about my book, how could they? But really I did it because I thought half of them would read it just to prove me wrong, so they could write me back and tell me, oh, you're awful, this is garbage. So within a week, all of them had contacted me back. They'd read it. All of them wanted to be my agent. So I had the luxury of going up to New York, which was really nothing I'd ever experienced before. All I had were rejections, as you said. And I interviewed them, and I picked the agent I had the best chemistry with, and he's my agent still today and one of my best friends. And then the book went out to the publishers on a Monday night. Back then, there were about 16 major publishers, far fewer today. And it was sold Tuesday morning after a bidding war. It was totally surreal for a guy who'd been writing for 17 or 18 years and really hadn't accomplished anything as far as being published. To have this happen overnight was absolutely amazing. And then the newspapers and all described me as an overnight sensation. I agree with that. It just took me about 10,000 nights to get there.
And the advance was significant.
The advance was enormous, ridiculously enormous. Never expected that. I was just hoping I could get an agent with this book, and maybe he would say, it's a good book. Why don't you write something else? Let's see if we could sell that. Really, that was my expectation, because why would I imagine this would be a big sale when I had never had anything like that before? So I was actually already starting on the second novel before Absolute Power even sold, because I didn't know who was going to sell.
David Baldacci, your particular skill is the way you put words onto paper, and not necessarily the plot. People can come up with plots, but the way you put words onto paper. You wrote a letter to Coach Smart at VCU urging him to stay with the Rams, even though you knew he would get far more offers. It was well done. I could have written a letter saying, Coach Smart, stick around. You did much better.
It was amazing. When Richmond Magazine contacted me, they said, would you write a letter to Coach Smart? We need it by X date. And I'm literally traveling the next 2 weeks. And I said, you know, I don't think I could do it justice, so I'm going to have to pass. And then I was in a hotel room in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I could not sleep, which happens to me a lot. So I got up at 2 a.m. I wrote that letter in 10 minutes. I emailed it off to Rich Magazine. I said, it's just a draft. You know, edit it as you want to, but here it is. Here are my feelings. This is what I wanted to say. Go with it. And I was surprised when they published it unedited. It was just sort of a thing. I got up in the middle of the night, and I wanted to write it, and I did.
I hope this question doesn't sound stupid. You're writing fiction. How important is imagination?
It's critically important. I do write fiction, so I make a lot of the things up. But what's important for me is that I base my fiction on a lot of fact. So I love knowledge and information. I do a lot of research for all the books. But what's important about research is you got to leave most of it out. Because you put a research in the book too much, it blocks the flow of the story. And all of a sudden it becomes a textbook instead of a novel. So I do the research so that I can take little bits and pieces of that research and distribute it evenly throughout the novel. So you never get to have a flip book where, you know, a writer's been doing a lot of research. They're kind of lazy. They don't want to integrate it into the novel. They don't want to leave any of the research out because they're so proud of it. And they just stick it in the novel somewhere, and you're reading the novel, and you come up against this research, and you start flipping pages. That's what I call a flip book, to get past all this junk that shouldn't have been in there in the first place and then get back to it. So I build my fiction on a mountain of fact.
You spoke to a group at a Henrico High School last night at Glen Allen High School, and you mentioned the research you did. I hesitate to ask you about the research you did on a particularly graphic torture scene in Deliver Us From Evil.
Yes. I've gotten so many emails and letters about that scene where people, they flipped past those pages. I mean, they really did. And the reason I did that, I really wanted to show a couple of things about the character. And the way you show things about character, you can either tell, so you can be the omniscient narrator and say, oh, this is an evil person and watch out for this person. Or you can show them doing something that's so horrific. It's labeled in your mind, this guy is a monster. So I like to show rather than tell. And that graphic scene, and it was beyond anything I'd done before, but what was most chilling about it was not exactly what the guy was doing to the other person, it was how he was doing it. It was sort of like a very pedantic tone where he was saying, and now this is going to be what's happening to you, and I'm checking your blood pressure, there won't be a problem, you're not going to spike yet, you know, you're not going to die, don't worry about it, we're just going to keep moving forward, and here's what's going to happen next. So the guy was doing it in a very normal tone, like he was a teacher talking to a student, and for me, that was the most chilling thing about it, because you're like, this guy doesn't seem like a psycho. What he's doing is psychopathic. But when he's talking to this guy, he seems like somebody you would see walking down the street, and you would never know he was a monster. For me, the monster, the really scary monsters are the ones you never see coming.
But it was the research. How did you come across that?
There is a mountain of research out there, if you know who to talk to and know where to look. Particularly in the former Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union, they were probably the best of the best. You think the Germans during World War II were really top-notch at torture? I don't think anybody had anything in the former Soviet Union. Those guys, the KGB and some of the other secret security services, they knew how to torture people. We're not talking about waterboarding, you know, or by playing loud music. This stuff was just graphic, unbelievable torture that was designed to break anyone.
You mentioned some research you did on an Amtrak train.
Yes, that was extraordinary. I will never do that again, where I was talking to a metal examiner when people on sitting at a table across from me thought I was trying to figure out how to kill somebody for real, and got into a little tussle with the Amtrak police, and had to do a lot of fast explaining that I was an author. It was unfortunate. I will never do that again, ever.
Describe it for us, because I was just rolling in the aisle last night.
Well, I was sitting in the Amtrak. I saw a train. There were two businessmen I was sharing the table with. I didn't know them. I had a friend who was a medical examiner in the medical examiner's office in the Bronx in New York. She was a recognized expert on poisoning and done a lot of research. And the way I was going to kill someone in the book was a poisoning technique. So I wanted to get her opinion. I wanted to do it face-to-face. I was just calling her on the phone to set up an interview. She was leaving town, would be gone for a while, so I decided, let's just do the questions now. So the questions were, okay, Doc, this is how I want to kill the guy. And I went through my poisoning technique, and I said, you know, I have to be able to fool the police, I have to be able to fool the medical examiner, they won't know that I murdered the person. And she told me they wouldn't, and she went on to say that if she were going to murder anybody, she'd do it exactly the way that I described, because it was foolproof, and we had a good conversation, and I clicked off, I looked up, these two businesswomen are freaking out completely, they thought I was planning to kill somebody. They called the police, Amtrak police guy. It was just a whole mess. and I did not get to New York when I was supposed to. And I had to put an apology in to the book Split Second to let people know that I was not, you know, a mass murderer. And again, I will never do that ever.
But you do research. You've written screenplays. As a matter of fact, you said you wrote screenplays even before yes. Absolute Power, which was turned into a great movie.
Yes.
Did you have anything to do with that?
I did. Bill Goldman, he's won 2 Academy Awards. He wrote the screenplay for Absolute Power. He did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, Marathon Man, Princess Bride. Legendary guy. They assigned him to write the screenplay. He came down from New York, and we went to a lot of the locations that I'd written about in the novel. He sort of picked my brain on different scenes. He would call me up from time to time. I could hear him clicking, clacking on the typewriter while he was asking me questions about it. And so it was a very, you know, educational process for me to be able to work with a guy like that. And I've since, you know, written a number of screenplays, either that I've had optioned or tried to sell. And I've worked with other directors and producers. And it's really, I think being a screenplay writer and having that experience behind you makes you a better novelist, because you have to be very tight and economical with the screenplay. There's not a lot of room for padding at all. Screenplay is 110, 120 pages, very tight margins. Each page equals about a minute of film. So if you have a 120-page script, it's about a two-hour film. If you have a lot of special effects, you're talking about $500,000 to $600,000 per page of filming. So every scene has to have at least 2 purposes for why it's in there. Every word has to be really thought through, every depth, every plot twist. So screenplay writing actually, I think, made me a better novelist.
Are you working on any more screenplays?
I have written one, actually, for the novel Wish You Well that I did years ago, and I was working with an A-list director, Ivan Reitman, who did all the big Ghostbusters and Stripes. He wanted to make the movie, but I eventually decided to turn Wish You Well into a novel, because that's really what it should have been first. I have some plans, actually, that we're putting together with a producer who I invested in a movie in Virginia that was shot with Jane Seymour and some others. Independent film project that went really well, and the whole community down at Smith Mountain Lake got behind it and helped with the catering, logistics, lodging, and all that. Great, and it's going to be a great film. So I'm thinking about, and it's still in the germination stage, but I had sort of an epiphany the other day. The script is already written to maybe have the whole state of Virginia behind the filming of Wish You Well. So we would film all across Virginia. We would involve local communities, use a Virginia cast, crew, raise money to finance it here, and have a whole state behind a film that really is a script and a story about the state of Virginia. I think it might be kind of cool.
For those who don't know, Wish You Well it starts in New York, but it goes down to Virginia, and the rest of the book takes place in Virginia as a girl discovers her roots.
That's right. 1940, it's multi-generational, and it's sort of, if I could dare to say it, because I'm a huge fan of the book and the author, it's sort of my Virginia version of To Kill a Mockingbird. And I wrote that book over a number of years. It's a very personal story. My mother grew up in Southwest Virginia on a mountaintop, very much like that. While the story is fictional, the play setting is not. And it really is kind of sort of a love letter for me to Virginia, and that's certainly that slice of Virginia. And it would be nice to see it on the big screen.
David Baldacci, you've written over 20 novels. Does writing come easily to you?
The ideas are easy. You know, the ideas come to me all the time. Taking in an idea and turning it into a story of 400 pages that would be compelling to someone other than, say, your mother, is to take a quote from Mark Twain, is the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug. And it just takes a lot of sweat equity to take an idea and turn it into a 400-page story that really, really will enthrall someone. And it takes a lot of work. You go down a lot of roads and you realize, it's not working. You got to come back, regroup, go down another road. I have no formula for how I write my novels. It's like I'm writing my first novel over and over and over again because I don't have a pre-programmed way to do it. It's like I sit down and sort of fly by the seat of my pants sometimes and let the creativity just run. Sometimes you make a wrong turn, you come back, you start over, and you go down another path. And it seems to work. Bill Goldman gave me the best advice years ago. He said, look, the first time you think you know as a writer what you're doing is when you've lost it as a writer. Because all of a sudden you ask yourself, what did I do before? And then that's when you fall into formula. How did I do it last time with the last book? And I'll just do it the same way this time and change the names. Great writers, I think, look forward and they say to themselves, how can I do it differently this time? How can I challenge myself to push the envelope a little bit more? And that's what I try to do.
Well, storytelling is a very ancient art. It predates writing.
Yes, it does.
And you use the written word. People who are listening to us now hear things. You have to use imagination when you write a book or tell a story. When you see it on the screen or on television, you don't have that much imagination left.
That's right. Yeah, you sit in the theater with your popcorn and your big Coke, and the director lays it all out for you in the film, and you're sort of a passive participant. You just sit there and take it all in. With a novel, you're an active participant. And I like to say that the novel is never finished. It's just a template until the reader reads it and puts his or her sort of stamp on it. And they finish the book and they say, wow, because they have a completely different interpretation of the other person across the room that might have read it. And that's because you get to take your own little thoughts and impressions and put it onto this book that I wrote and then sort of make it yours.
What separates you from other writers? What drives you? What drives your plots? You have a number of different characters that sometimes recur, and you can go in a number of different directions. What drives you? Or what drives your plots?
I think that I'm ever curious. I think good writers need to be ever curious about what's going on in the world around them. I like to write about things not necessarily that I know a lot about, but that I would like to know a lot about. And then I go out, and I'm passionate about it, and I find out a lot of stuff, and I sit down, and I am jazzed. I'm really juiced to write this story. And it feels fresh and new because it was fresh and new for me. And if I excite myself while I'm writing it, I really think I'll excite the reader while they're reading it. And that's sort of the difference for me. I try to go out there and do new stuff and take on new challenges and try to see something that I've never experienced before. Take the reader along for the ride.
I don't mean to digress, but you might want to take a Paris vacation. I'll set the plot in Paris, and I'll just go over there and charge it off to...
I know. When I did Deliver Us From Evil... And there's a lot of it takes place in Provence. The research for that was just excruciating. I don't think I'd ever do that again. I mean, how much wine can you drink?
Can we try? Do you ever find that some of your characters are writing their own dialogue?
All the time. In fact, I've written some books where I thought early on that one character was going to really carry the narrative oar and be the major character. And all of a sudden, you have these peripheral characters sort of jumping up and down, you know, like Hermione Granger and Harry Potter. Pick me, because I'm far more interesting. And then you start looking over those characters, and you're like, you know what, you're kind of right. You're right. You're all more interesting. And then you bring them center stage, put the spotlight on them, and sort of change the way the story flows. And I, with the Camel Club, which I've really gotten to know after 5 books, yes, well, I'm sitting there writing dialogue for Oliver Stone or Reuben Rhodes or Annabelle Conroy, and I write it one way. I hear it a little bit in my ear. You know, it's kind of like, I wouldn't say that. You know, come on. I'm Oliver Stone. That's not something I would say. And I would go, you're right, Oliver. I mean, I'd hit the delete key, and I'd hit it again, try it again. So, yes, you do get to know them. And in your head, you have all those little voices that go on, because after a number of books, they really do become fairly real to you.
One of your characters is Oliver Stone, and somebody said, well, I've enjoyed your movies. And you, so you must have deliberately picked a name that...
I did Oliver Stone for me, because my Oliver Stone is very much the conspiracy theorist. He sees a conspiracy around every corner. The director, Oliver Stone, has certainly done some great conspiracy movies. That was sort of a homage, a tip of the hat to... the director, Oliver Stone.
David, you spoke to a number of Henrico County students. What kind of questions did they ask? Here's an author in front of them. Many of them want to be authors. What did they ask you?
The questions were pretty sophisticated. You know, there's one question the student asked and said, you know, I have trouble deciding when to place literary devices into my novels. Do you have that trouble as well? And how do you go about deciding where you want to put your literary devices? I was talking to that student about, you know, the literary devices versus, you know, where you don't want to get to is having contrivances where you sort of build something and you know the purpose you want it in there instead of letting it flow naturally in the story. So that was a pretty sophisticated question. They wanted to know about the research. You know, at what depth do I do the research? Is it more important for me to sort of read things or go out and talk to people and see how they do things? And obviously I told them, you know, the latter is really important, to go out and talk to people and see how they do things, particularly in the fields of law enforcement and intelligence gathering. People don't write this stuff down in books. It's sort of seat of the pants, out in the trenches. They improvise all the time. So the only way you find out this stuff is to go out and actually talk to them. So really, really good questions. Obviously, the students have really thought it through, talking about, you know, factual history versus how you fictionalize it, as I did in Wish You Well. I was very impressed with the questions.
Do you read?
All the time. And the only difference is my wife is a voracious reader, too. She always has a book. We read very differently, though. She will start a book and finish it and then go on to another book. I flit around. I read 5 or 6 books at the same time. And I might read, you know, one book one night for 20 or 30 pages. The next night, I want another type of experience. I'll read another book. Drives her absolutely nuts when I do it that way. But it works for me. So I always have a number of books going.
When do you have time? It would seem that you're writing or you're going on promotional tours, you're book signing,
Yeah, it is. I pick my spots, but since I love to read and reading relaxes me, typically instead of watching TV at night, my wife and I will just read. And that's really, I usually read before I go to bed for at least an hour or so. And that's the time where I really get to relax. And if I'm reading a really good book, I'm thinking about it during the day and wanting to get back to it. It's just it's sort of a thrill. And I found that other people have that. Last night, a lot of people came up to me and said, you know, I stopped reading when I got out of college, haven't read in 20 years, picked up a book, whether it was mine or someone else's. And they said, all of a sudden it hit me. I'm like, God, how much fun it is to read a book. And now they said, I'm always reading. I've rediscovered the love of reading. Because you get to go into a little cocoon for a while, leave the world you're in, sit down with a book and turn pages and just escape. And it's a great, great experience.
I believe all of your books, or most of your books at least, have been turned into audiobooks.
Yes.
And many of our listeners complain about the difficulty of finding new books in an accessible format. Does an author have to be a bestseller in order to have the book turned into an audiobook?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly if you're a bestseller, you're going to be turned into an audiobook. Audiobooks tend to be fairly expensive to produce just because they have to hire readers to do it. They have to do the script. If it's a bridge, you have to cut the book down probably in half. I never even looked at the bridge scripts anymore because the first time I did that, they sent me the abridged script for Absolute Power. I realized they'd taken half the book out of the abridged script. And I started writing all this stuff back in, and I sent it back up to them. And they said, okay, this is fine. You added 25,000 words. Now, all you have to do is cut out 25,000 words from someplace else because we have an absolute word limit. I don't even know why they do abridged anymore. And they do unabridged of all my books, which is great. But, yeah, it takes a little bit of time. I don't know what the rule is in publishing, actually, when they will do an audiobook. I know that they're very profitable for publishers, and they're very popular. And you can get them in many formats now. You can get them as a cassette. They don't do cassettes anymore, but it's a CD. You can also get them downloaded directly to your iPod if you want that. They have MP3 players. So there are a lot of venues for it, but I guess not every book gets turned into an audiobook.
I hope this doesn't come out of left field, but do you have any personal experience with anyone having a vision problem or Parkinson's disease or stroke or anything that would limit their ability to read?
Yes. I actually went down to Walter Reed Hospital about 3 years ago, where the amputee ward, with soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, who obviously had a lot of physical problems, no arms, vision impaired, because of injuries suffered over there. We brought down a bunch of, they're called playaways. And playaways are basically MP3 players with the entire audiobook loaded onto it that you can have a strap you wear it around your neck. And had a little earphones. And the soldiers, while they were getting fitted with prosthetics and doing their physical therapy, since some of them didn't have hands to hold a book, some of them were vision impaired, they would just listen to it while they were working out and listen to the book while they were doing their physical therapy and rehabbing. So that was, quite extraordinary. And I think, the playaways are a terrific thing for that. And it allows people who otherwise wouldn't be able to enjoy a book to listen to every word of it. It was really heartening to see that.
David Baldacci, I know that one of your passions is literacy. What is the state of literacy in the United States right now?
Abysmal. The last survey they did on a national basis was about 3 years ago, and there are 200 million adults in the United States, and this survey graded 100 million adults, half the adult population, at having far below average literacy skills. 50 million of them were totally illiterate. Another 50 million couldn't read a grocery list, certainly couldn't read a newspaper. And those numbers are growing. The national high school graduation rate is 62%. Which means that 38% of the kids aren't even graduating from high school. So they are doomed socioeconomically. There's no way they can compete against kids from South Korea, China, and India who have 3 PhDs. So we are doing a big disservice. And what really rankles me is that you have forces out there saying that the economic depression that we're in right now, or recession we're in right now, is due to the fact that teachers make too much money, which is unbelievable to me. It's like, hedge fund managers who only pay 15% in income tax, they have to give up that third jet and that second yacht. But here you have teachers making $30,000 and $40,000 a year and going to CarMax and buying a used Toyota. That's just awful. We got to help those hedge fund managers. They need to make more money. So that's extraordinary to me. Right now you see the up-and-coming, the most viable powerhouse, economic powerhouses out there globally are the ones who hold their teachers to a very high level, pay them what they're worth, because they are teaching the future. We need to get back to teaching the future in the United States. Right now, we're losing the war fast.
You have the Wish You Well Foundation.
Yes. We started that about 11 years ago, my wife and I. We pumped a lot of money, into millions of dollars, into the Wish You Well Foundation. And we provide grants to literacy organizations across the country. We've done programs, funded programs, in over 42 states. a number of them here in Virginia. And it's interesting, we get probably 2,000 applications a year, even though we're a relatively small foundation. We get applications from, obviously, private literacy organizations trying to teach people how to read. We're getting more and more, and this is a state of the times we live in, we get more and more applications from public school systems. The state of Washington, Seattle, wrote to us and said, we need $10,000. We have a library. We have no budget. We have no money in our budget to buy books. Seattle, you know, or other. And we get grant applications from state school systems across the country who have no money in their budgets for stuff that when I was growing up, you would take for granted that you could have a book, you know, if you needed it in the classroom. You can't take that for granted anymore.
The Wish You Well Foundation was named for a book you wrote.
Yes, it was.
We alluded to it before in this interview. You have a few things for to read from it.
Yes, I do. This is chapter 5 in Wish You Well, when Lou Cardinal is a 12-year-old girl whose father was killed in an accident. She lived in New York with her little brother Oz, and they are traveling by train to Virginia from New York City to live with their great-grandmother on a mountaintop in southwest Virginia. It was very early morning when the birds had barely awoken and thumped their wings to life, and cold mists were rising from the warm ground, and the sun was only a seam of fire in the eastern sky. They had made one stop in Richmond, where the locomotive had been changed, and the train had cleared the Shenandoah Valley, the most splendidly fertile soil and temperate climate for growing virtually anything. Now the angle of land was far steeper. Lou had slept little because she had shared the top bunk with Oz, who was restless at night under the best circumstances. On a swaying train heading to a new, terrifying world, her little brother had been a wildcat in his sleep. Her limbs had been bruised from his unconscious flailing, despite her holding him tight. Her ears were hurting from his tragic screams, in spite of her whispered words of comfort. Lou had finally climbed down, touched the cold floor with bare feet, stumbled to the window in the darkness, pulled back the curtains, and been rewarded by seeing her first Virginia mountain face to face.
David Baldacci reading from his own book. Most, if not all, of David Baldacci's books are available commercially as audiobooks on CD. And many are on CD at the Henrico Public Library. Many are also available to our listeners from the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. The telephone number for the Library and Resource Center of the Virginia Department for the Blind and Vision Impaired is 804-371-3661 or 1-800-552-7015. David Baldacci, thank you.
Thank you.
For the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.